the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Thursday morning. A big round of applause goes out to Real California Milk Dairy Processors, who took home 50 awards from the 2019 annual cheese competition held by the American Cheese Society. And a shout out to several other California cheesemakers who brought home an additional 31 awards at the competition as well. In a field of 247 processors from across the United States, Canada, Colombia, and Venezuela, 14 cow's milk and cheese dairy companies won awards made with 100% real California milk. California has roughly 1,200 dairies, one of which I'm proud my family is a part of. Moving on to what's happening in today's show, Brian German is talking with us about the Farm Evaluation and Nitrogen Management Plan Report. You'll hear about Farm Bureau announcing its 2020 Ag Innovation Challenge. Taylor Hillman has details on why managing dust is important during almond harvest. And I'm starting off the show today with news from President Donald Trump regarding tariffs. Let's jump right in. President Trump delays the most recent tariff hike until December. Earlier this month, President Donald Trump announced an additional 10% tax on $300 billion worth of Chinese exports into the United States. That tariff was set to begin on September 1st. However, according to the National Association of Farm Broadcasters, the Trump administration will delay part of a planned tariff increase on China until December. The U.S. Trade Representative's office made the announcement Tuesday that the administration would not implement the planned tariffs. Instead, the tariffs will be implemented on December 15th of this year. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer says certain products are even being removed from the tariff list based on health, safety, national security, and other factors, and it will not face the additional tariffs of 10%. The move likely gives Lighthizer more time to negotiate with China, which the two sides are set to meet again next month in Washington. However, the tariffs threaten again to stall the negotiations as China responded by announcing a halt of purchases of U.S. agriculture products. President Trump claims the delay is part of an effort to avoid the impact of tariffs on holiday shopping, as some of those items include cell phones, video games, and clothing. However, the two sides did talk over the phone this week, and Trump called the talks positive, adding a deal could be coming soon. And now here's Taylor Hillman with more agriculture news.
Specialty crop news brought to you today by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com/growers. It's harvest time for almonds around the state, and that means growers need to be thinking about how to limit dust during this period. But why is this so important? The Almond Board of California has created a new video that coincides with one of its Almond Orchard 2025 goals, reducing dust at harvest by 50%.
As industry leaders, we all take pride in caring for our communities and producing the best product for the world to enjoy. Working together to reduce harvest-related dust by 50% by 2025 is an important goal that will have a far-reaching impact from our harvesting teams to our neighbors to farming families throughout the entire state. We all benefit from improving our harvesting practices. The mitigation of dust means stepping up as leaders in responsible and efficient farming practices. It means maintaining our roads, focusing on pre-harvest management, and prioritizing operating efficiencies and speeds. When we all come together to support these and other dust-reducing best practices, like investing in low-dust equipment, others will take notice, and our communities will thank us. Californians' almond growers and our hardworking teams of operators are proud to be stewards of the land, deeply connected to our orchards as well as to the people who live and work alongside us. Managing harvest dust is our responsibility and our legacy. To learn more about managing dust at harvest, please visit almonds.com/harvest dust.
Again, that's almonds.com/harvest dust. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West.
The due date for the Farm Evaluation and Nitrogen Management Plan reporting for the 2018 crop year was originally March 1st, but the deadline has been extended to August 28th. Non-compliance letters have been sent out as an additional reminder that all rice farmers will need to complete the reporting requirements. The extension is being offered to provide one last opportunity for farmers to meet the regulatory requirement. The farm evaluation and the nitrogen management plan are regulatory conditions of the rice waste discharge requirements order issued by the Central Valley Water Board, requiring the web templates to be completed once a year. Rice growers in the Sacramento Valley are required to submit the farm evaluation to the California Rice Commission for preparing a summary report to the Central Valley Water Board. The two-part nitrogen management plan report must be kept on the farm. In September, the California Rice Commission will provide information of noncompliance with the Central Valley Water Board for potential regulatory action. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
A nationwide Ag Innovation Challenge is officially open. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters says the American Farm Bureau Federation has opened online applications for the 2020 Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge. In its sixth year, the report says the Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge is a national business competition for U.S. food and agricultural startups. Entrepreneurs will compete for $145,000 in startup funds provided by sponsors Farm Credit, John Deere, Bayer Crop Science, Farm Bureau Bank, Country Financial, and Farm Bureau Financial Services. AFBF President Zippy Duvall said they are very interested to see how entrepreneurs will use startup funds provided by the challenge to take their businesses to the next level. To apply for the 2020 Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge, competitors can apply online at www.fb.org. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time of day, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Farm City Newsday on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Farm City Newsday, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City Newsday. We've got more agriculture news right now.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture is still accepting applications for the 2019 Climate Smart Agriculture Technical Assistance Funding. Funds that are awarded through the competitive grant process will be distributed to resource conservation districts, the University of California Cooperative Extension, and nonprofit organizations that have demonstrated technical expertise in designing and implementing agricultural management practices to support CDFA's 2019 CSA incentive programs. Eligible organizations can request as much as $120,000 to provide technical assistance to applicants and awardees of the 2019 Alternative Manure Management Program and the 2019 Healthy Soils Program. A description of the technical assistance program and links to the application materials can be found on the CDFA website. Applications are due by 5 p.m. on Friday, August 30th. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. Applications are still being accepted for the Young Farmers and Ranchers Annual Excellence in Agriculture Award. Chair of the California Young Farmers and Ranchers, Daniel Bays, noted what the award celebrates and how to apply.
The Excellence in Agriculture Award looks at people that maybe aren't directly involved in farming, but in a support industry. So that might be crop protection or selling farm equipment or doing some type of consulting or a support industry tied to agriculture, you know, and how they've grown that business and been involved with Farm Bureau and their contributions to the community and the agriculture community as a whole. Probably the best way to nominate a person would be encourage them to apply or have multiple people encourage them to apply and work with their county Farm Bureau. Because there is in the application process, they do need some of your personal information related to your business as far as acres farmed and how it's grown and changed.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, or FMCSA, published a notice of proposed rulemaking on the changes to the hours of service rules. Those rules specify the permitted operating hours of commercial drivers. Last year, FMCSA took public comments on portions of the rules to alleviate unnecessary burdens placed on drivers. And in response, the agency received more than 5,200 comments. So based on those comments, the proposed rule on hours of service offers offers five key revisions. They include the agency proposing to increase safety and flexibility for the 30-minute brake rule by tying the brake requirement to 8 hours of driving time without an interruption for at least 30 minutes. The agency also proposes to modify the sleeper berth exception to allow drivers to split their required 10 hours off duty into two periods, one of at least 7 consecutive hours in the sleeper berth, the other period not less than 2 consecutive hours. The agency also proposes to allow one off-duty break of at least 30 minutes, but not more than 3 hours. The agency also proposes to modify the adverse driving conditions exemption by extending by 2 hours the maximum window during which driving is permitted. They also propose a change to the short-haul exception available to certain commercial drivers by lengthening the driver's maximum on-duty period from 12 to 14 hours. Now, the public comment period on these proposed changes will be open for 45 days. To see the Federal Register notice, including on how to submit comments, simply go to fmcsa.gov. That's www.fmcsa.gov. And U.S. beef exports to South Korea continue to soar. With more on that story, here's Joe Sheely.
U.S. beef exports to South Korea set a new monthly value record in June at more than $178 million. For the first half of the year, export value to Korea is 15% ahead of last year's record pace. In this U.S. Meat Export Federation report, USMEF Korea Director Ji-hae Yang discusses some of the factors behind this trend.
U.S. beef has been successfully established in the Korean retail and food service market, but it also rapidly gaining popularity in e-commerce sector. So recent export growth is not only in the typical Korean items like a short rib or chakai roll, but in underutilized cuts like a short plate, brisket points, cloth, and even the round. Because end users recognize the versatility and affordability of the high-quality U.S. beef.
The U.S. beef industry is also capitalizing on Korean consumers' desire for convenience.
Now in Korea, the quality of home meal replacement is almost equivalent to restaurant food quality. Price point of home meal replacement is about 40 to 50% of restaurant menu price. Meal kit, for example, costs about $10 to $12 for two people. Local beef cannot meet this price point. So U.S. beef is capturing this fast-growing opportunity.
For more information, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm Joe Sheely.
Thanks, Joe, and I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Like most in agriculture in many parts of the country this year, when it comes to hitting the field, those in the custom harvester industry might find their schedule slightly off due to the significant moisture in the soils and subsequent delays in field work. Even prevented plantings. Yet Rafe Joliffe of U.S. Custom Harvesters says no matter the schedule, there is year-round work for members of his association. Equipment repair, improvements, and preparation during the wintertime. Then,
we'll have guys that are ready to run in March and early April and be chopping silage or forage somewhere. The grain guys, they'll be ready to fire up the 1st of May or earlier if need be, depending on where they start. The season will run where you're at, what you're going.
Now, you may have heard Joliffe say that it's not just grain harvesting work performed by custom harvesters in their cross-country treks. Forage and silage harvest can also be part of a harvester's assignment. Joliffe says he made the switch from grain to forest harvesting 4 years ago. But forage and silage harvest for custom harvesters is nothing new.
The organization as a whole has had forage members for many years.
In fact, custom harvesting of forage and silage is almost a year-round activity in its own right.
There's guys in Arizona that are literally running 10, 11 months out of the year. Any member could be running at any point of the time. Anything can be harvested for forage. You've got your alfalfas. The things we typically think of are corn silage or sorghum silage.
And Joliffe adds forage and silage harvesting for custom harvesters and producers in general represent some of agriculture's ingenuity, adaptability, and potential market opportunity. A grower colleague of Joliffe's recently began chopping corn stalks, bagging it, and mixing it with distiller's grain to supplement livestock feed. He says what began as practicality could lead to a value-added product that could add more to the producer's pocketbook, and in the case of harvesters, more employment opportunities. Or as Jolliffe summarizes,
if it'll chop, if it'll feed, if it'll produce for America, why aren't we doing it?
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
What we can do to help bring back the bee population. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Bees are the winged wonders that are really important to us, but unfortunately are a dwindling population. Bees occur on every continent except Antarctica, and wherever you find insect-pollinated flowering plants, you will find bees. Of the nearly 20,000 known bee species in the world, 4,000 live in the U.S. Though these guys play a vital role in our agriculture and honey production, they're native to Europe and were introduced to America in the 1600s. According to a Cornell University study published in 2012, crops pollinated by honeybees and other insects contributed $29 billion to U.S. farm income in 2010. Here are just some of the fruits and veggies bumblebees help pollinate: squash, pumpkin, zucchini, cranberries, apples, green beans, scarlet beans, runner beans, cucumber, strawberries, tomatoes, sweet peppers, blueberries, cherries, kiwi fruit, raspberries, blackberries, and watermelon. You can help bees by providing some of these flowering plants or flowers in your garden. Because most queens overwinter in small holes on or just below the ground surface, avoid raking, tilling, or mowing your yard until April or May. If you do need to mow, do so with the mower blade set at the highest safe level. Wherever possible, avoid insecticides and herbicides. In particular, steer clear of systemic pesticides such as neonicotinoids, which are taken up by the vascular systems of plants. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So one recipe that I want to share with everybody is a simple recipe, and being that I am a Mexican-American, there's one thing I'm really great at. It's making beans. And I know it's funny, and a lot of people tell me all the time, how are your beans? You can tell a lot by the way a guy cooks Mexican food based off of the way he makes beans. I think it's very important also to have a special way of not only making beans, but also a signature way of doing it. Now, the hardest part about making beans is understanding when are they fully done. Now, there's this misconception we all have that beans are always supposed to be mushy, and that's not necessarily true. The best beans are the ones that are al dente, which means that they're to the tooth, fully cooked all the way through, and you can actually bite through them. Now, there's different types of beans. The most common and my most favorite is working with just a good old pinto bean. But it's what we do to the beans that really makes it so much more special. Let's get started. The very first thing I'm going to do is teach everybody the ratio. Whenever you make beans, no matter how many you're making, you do one part beans, three parts liquid. And I cannot stress that enough, because if you don't have enough liquid in there, and beans are going to expand about three times their size. And I know that sounds kind of hard to believe, but it is very, very true. So I always do, if I'm going to do 1 cup of beans, I'm doing 3 cups of beef stock. Now, I like using stock as opposed to water, because already we have a really great base and a great flavor. I like to also drop into the beans a whole onion, a whole carrot, and a whole celery. Now, this is important to get extra flavor out. Now, obviously, when we go to serve our beans, we want to remove all these because they're going to be just wilted down and completely just all the flavor sucked out of them. So they're going to be pretty much flavorless, but it's all going to be in that stock. And it's so important whenever you're making great beans that we want to make sure our liquid has all the flavor in it. So that way you're not having to put extra salt or anything in your beans afterwards. You're able to just enjoy them. I let them cook in my pressure cooker. Now, you don't have to have a pressure cooker. If you have a pressure cooker, once we hit full pressure, I'm going to go ahead and bring that down to a medium low and just get almost what you would call a simmer, but for the next hour. And I cook them for 1 hour on a medium low heat after I hit full pressure. Now, I always want to make sure that the liquid hasn't completely evaporated out of my pot. This is very important because we also want to make sure beans do burn fast, and if they run out of liquid, they will burn. After 1 hour of cooking, slowly release the pressure and enjoy. I'm Albert J. Hernandez, and you can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leal. For today's interview segment, we take a listen to the House Agriculture Subcommittee hearing on assessing the effectiveness of the National Organic Program. To listen to the full hearing, you can visit agriculture.house.gov. But for time's sake, we're jumping straight to the testimony and question portion of the hearing, where Chairman Plaskett and Member Dunn discuss the NOP with Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Greg Ibach. Let's take a listen.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman Plaskett and Ranking Member Dunn, and other members of the subcommittee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. I look forward to our discussion of organic agriculture and the critical role USDA's National Organic Program plays in ensuring the integrity of the organic label. I am Greg Ibaugh, Undersecretary for USDA's Marketing and Regulatory Programs Mission Area. With me today, as has been introduced, is Dr. Jennifer Tucker, the Deputy Administrator who oversees the National Organic Program, or NOP. Today, I'd like to provide an update on both our foreign and domestic enforcement activities. I will also update you on the Department's implementation of the organic provisions of the 2018 Farm Bill. Protecting the integrity of the organic label is more important than ever as the industry continues to grow. Sales reached a record $52.5 billion in 2018, up over 6% from the previous year. This includes 1,000 new farms that were certified in the U.S. last year. This growth has been supported by USDA's development of clear and enforceable organic standards. These standards describe how farmers grow crops and raise livestock and which herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers they may use throughout the process. Congress established the NOP as a public-private partnership, so certifiers are key to enforcement. The NOP ensures each certifier has the experience, training, and tools they need to be effective. However, when compliance is not achieved, certifiers are suspended. For example, in May, NOP suspended a certifier's office in Turkey because they could not demonstrate the ability to effectively oversee organic operations in the Black Sea region. This heightened oversight and enforcement since 2016 has resulted in at least 180 operations in that region losing their organic certification. By weeding out these bad actors, USDA helps create opportunities for expanded organic production here in the U.S. Another success story involves our collaboration with APHIS. In March, APHIS notified NOP staff that a shipment of organic bell peppers to Philadelphia had been fumigated, a prohibited practice under the NOP regulations. They provided evidence used to identify the importer and prevent the peppers from being marketed as organic in the U.S. In addition to enhanced oversight of imports, we are also overseeing and protecting the domestic market. The NOP resolves just under 500 inquiries and investigations every year. 85% of those involve U.S.-based businesses. The NOP has increased its coordination with the USDA Office of Inspector General for criminal violations, and a recent investigation resulted in significant penalties for domestic fraud. This case involved $140 million in sales of grain, which was fraudulently marketed as organic. Finally, I want to thank you for the enhanced enforcement provisions provided in the 2018 Farm Bill, and I will provide the following highlights on our implementation progress to date. Provisions requiring import certificates and closing certification loopholes will be included in the strengthening organic enforcement rulemaking that AMS was working on prior to passage of the 2018 Farm Bill. AMS expects to publish this proposed rule this fall. In May, AMS Customs and Border Protection and APHIS formed an interagency working group for coordination, reporting, and information sharing related to organic imports and integrity. The first working group meeting was on June 27th. AMS recently entered into an interagency agreement with CBP to automate NOP's import certificate to reduce paper processing and improve traceability and accountability for organic imports. With these new Farm Bill tools and a renewed emphasis on enforcement, USDA is committed to supporting organic farmers and ranchers by developing clear standards and creating a level playing field to support farmers and businesses producing organic food. A level playing field across countries also expands opportunities to open new markets for U.S. organic businesses. Again, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for being here. And this is, I think, a burgeoning area. People are enormously interested in this. Everyone wants to know what's happening in organics in all of our districts. I think that's part of the reason why we have the number of members that are on this subcommittee, particularly because of the organic component to it. And I'm glad to hear, one of the things I wanted you all to talk about is as if you could help me understand, just a moment, you said that your testimony focused on enforcement measures used to protect against fraudulent organic imports. I think that is important to protect consumer confidence, but it underscores the idea that our domestic production cannot keep up with demand. What is NOP doing to help grow domestic production?
I think one of the most important things that we're doing to help spur domestic production is taking action against fraudulent imports. You know, domestic producers need to have a level playing field to be able to compete on, and when imports don't meet the same standards that are expected of our domestic producers, that creates that unfair playing field that they struggle with. So I think as we've seen the reduction in the number of certified operations outside the United States, we've seen growth within the United States as there's more opportunities provided to fill that.
But now, if you are suspending certification in some instances of exporters, how will domestic supply chains be impacted by that? What percentage of that is exports that would cause a change to the supply chain?
So we're seeing a good response. Most of the imports coming in were feed grains that were used in animal agriculture, organic animal agriculture. And we're seeing more producers across the country, especially in the Midwest, where some of them operate at scale, that are embracing the opportunity and the margins that they see in the organic industry.
Okay. I want to applaud the NOP's certification cost share program for assisting producers in offsetting expenses related to organic certification. In my district, in the Virgin Islands, unfortunately, we have a low number of farmers that are certified as organic growers. In addition to the efforts under the cost share program, what steps has the department taken to increase technical assistance, outreach to increase organic certifications among small or medium-sized farmers in areas that may not be as advanced in this?
So the cost share program, as you know, in the last administration was transferred from AMS to FSA, Farm Service Agency, and producers now go into their local Farm Service Agency office to apply for those cost share dollars. And but we're also working to be able to have materials available on the website as well as through other avenues to increase producers' awareness of how to go about qualifying.
Is there a means for them to get physical assistance from a human being, other than a pamphlet or website to support them, helping them walk through that? What would be the component of USDA that would assist them in doing that?
So are you specifically asking about the cost share program?
No, or other ways of getting technical support?
Yeah, the certifiers is their main responsibility to do that. And so by making sure our certifiers are educated and they have access to understanding where to approach them, they provide a lot of that educational opportunity.
And how do we expand the number of certifiers that are available for people to get that assistance?
So certifiers are a third-party system, and that's is driven by market demand. And as we have more demand, we'll see more certifiers.
And my last question is, what is the status of the origin of livestock rule that was previously proposed by your agency? What can we expect your agency to issue a final rule on that one?
So we're also very interested in the origin of livestock rule. We've heard from a number of clients across the country of their interest in that. We share the interest in completing the rulemaking process, and we're exploring the best options to get that done. We hope to have a rule drafted for interagency review yet this year.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. Any advancements in science and technology are based in research. It often requires a significant investment in the time and resources, but the outcomes can make a real-world difference for those back home on the farm. In this segment from Holstein Association USA, we learn how the organization supports research to continue improving profitability for U.S.-registered Holstein breeders. Melissa Gregory has the report.
Every great scientific discovery begins with an idea. Innovative research is the backbone of progress in any industry, and that includes the dairy community. Supporting research is a top priority for Holstein Association USA, the world's largest dairy breed association. Roger Shanks, the organization's genetics consultant, explains.
I'm real excited about the research grant program that Holstein Association has ongoing. We're getting into our third request for proposals this year. The overall objective of the whole program is really to try to increase the amount of research that's done on Holstein cows so that we can help then the Holstein members be able to implement and take advantage of those research results as they come along.
Holstein Association USA is currently funding two projects, one at North Carolina State University that's looking at how genomic information can be used to manage inbreeding, and a second project at the University of California, Davis, exploring the opportunity to breed Holstein cows for heat tolerance using the slick hair gene. Both hold great potential for future progress with U.S. registered Holsteins.
I think it's a constant challenge to continue to be the perfect cow. What do we need to be prepared for when there's the next technology change or other things that come into play? With genetics, if we make selection decisions, we're then looking at an offspring that's going to be born 9 months or however long later. And so there is a difference in the when the response occurs and when you can see the benefit of a particular decision.
The dairy industry has seen major changes in recent years, and there's reason to be optimistic about what's possible in the future, Shank says.
And now, I mean, we have robotic milkers and other things that are coming about with the genomics that and who knows what the next advance will be that will make a difference. Technology is going to help make it easier for dairy producers to have this outstanding cow produce these large amounts of milk to feed the world. And it's the future is bright.
Holstein Association USA is currently accepting research proposals for the next round of funding. Applications are due August 15th, and you can learn more at HolsteinUSA.com. For Holstein Association USA, I'm Melissa Gregory.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.